My name is Aaron J. French, and I am the editor-in-chief of Dark Discoveries Magazine, a genre magazine that explores dark fantasy and horror fiction, as well as certain metaphysical themes that might be considered as weird. It gives me great pleasure to present the following interview with author and researcher Graham Hancock. This interview was conducted on the 11th of June, 2015, and is featured in Dark Discoveries Magazine issue number 31, The Occult in Dark Fiction, where a full transcript of the interview is featured. I want to thank Graham for taking the time to speak with Dark Discoveries, and we'll get things started with the first question. So, Graham, I was hoping you could begin by telling us a little about how you made the transition to writing fiction after so many years of writing nonfiction, also the role that ayahuasca and altered states of consciousness played making that transition, and how all this culminated in your first novel, Entangled.
Okay, yeah. I've always regarded myself as first and foremost a writer rather than a researcher or somebody working in the field of archaeology or consciousness or anything like that. My self-identification is first and foremost as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I have felt that way since I was about 10 years old. And it just, my writing career took me in the direction of journalism in the early 1970s, and then in the direction of non-fiction books, but non-fiction books about current affairs issues. I was still very much plugged into the journalist paradigm. Now, I was writing non-fiction books and doing journalism because that's what I could get paid for doing. But what I actually liked doing was writing stories and writing fiction. And I always hoped that that a time would come when I could do some work on a novel or on a series of novels. And sure enough, since the nonfiction did well and cut me some slack and gave me some space in my life to explore other avenues of creativity, quite late in life, around about the year 2006, 2007, I got to a place where I could just take time off completely from the nonfiction writing and try my hand at writing what became my first novel, Entangled. I mean, it's interesting. There are definite differences between writing fiction and nonfiction. First and foremost, with nonfiction, particularly in the controversial areas that I operate on, I'm presenting an argument. And that argument goes against the mainstream view. It goes against the views that historians and archaeologists give us about almost everything. So if I'm presenting an argument, I've got to thoroughly nail it down. I've got to take account of what my critics might say, how they might attack me, and boy, do they attack alternative ideas. And as far as possible, to bulletproof my argument against them. This involves footnotes. In the case of some books, as many as, you know, 2,000 footnotes in a book. Whereas with fiction, all of that goes away. There are no furious critics who are going to attack me because they claim that I haven't represented the facts correctly, and I don't have to produce 27 footnotes to prove that I have represented the facts correctly. You know, hey, relax, guys. It's just fiction. So that's a tremendous liberation, and it just, there's an immediate feeling of freedom as a writer when you step from one genre into the other, and that doesn't stop me from exploring extraordinary or difficult ideas in my novels. I'm just doing so in a different way. I think the narrative, the central narrative skill that makes a nonfiction book work can also make a fiction book work. But there's something else in fiction which doesn't happen in nonfiction, and that is characters. You have to create characters. If you don't create characters who are believable, who readers identify with, then you're dead in the water. And that is not a skill that you're necessarily equipped for in writing nonfiction books. And it's something that I've had to learn as I go along, how best to do that, how best to handle dialogue. I mean, some fiction authors are just absolutely brilliant at dialogue, and I wonder how much that is a result of just years and years and years of hard work and carefully listening to how people speak to one another, and how much it's a born gift that some of us have and some of us don't have. In my case, I've had to work on that, but I think that I'm learning as I go along. So briefly, it wasn't so much a transition. It was something I always wanted to do, and it was something that I finally got space in my life to do, where I could take time out and really explore this different genre. But the second part of your question concerning ayahuasca, is interesting, because I began to drink ayahuasca, which is the sacred medicine of the Amazon jungle, the sacred vine. It's actually a mixture of two different plants, one of which contains dimethyltryptamine, the most powerful hallucinogen known to man. And it's been used for sacred purpose by shamans in the Amazon for thousands and thousands of years. And it affects their creativity enormously. There's a huge body of art which is created by Amazonian shamans. And interestingly, there's a huge body of art which is created by Western artists as well, who have worked with ayahuasca. And it was because of this that I first began to consider the idea of going down to the Amazon and drinking ayahuasca. I was writing a nonfiction book. I was writing a nonfiction book that became Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. It concerned cave art, which contains many of the elements of ayahuasca visionary art. And I realized that in order to research that book properly, I needed to have the kinds of experiences that we thought that the ancient shamans in Upper Paleolithic times were having. And I realized I could do that by going and drinking this powerful visionary brew with shamans in the Amazon. So initially it was a research project for a nonfiction book. But the effects of ayahuasca were so transformatory, so extraordinary, so nourishing to my imagination and my spirit, but also so difficult and so challenging. It's like an initiation. I mean, it's incredibly hard work, and it's very, very demanding psychically. All of that. Once I'd finished the book Supernatural, I realized that I wanted to carry on drinking ayahuasca. And I found people can mistake this, you know, they think, oh, ayahuasca is a drug, quote unquote, the man is addicted to a drug. It's impossible to get addicted to ayahuasca. You have to brace yourself every time you drink it. It tastes ghastly. It makes you vomit. I mean, nobody's doing this for fun. It's the deep personal work that it unleashes, which is of great value. And I decided that I had more work to do with ayahuasca, and so I continued to drink it. Now, I was aware that friends of mine like Martina Hoffman in Boulder, Colorado, and Alex Gray, the great visionary artist who works out of New York State, had both had their art dramatically affected by their encounters with ayahuasca. I can't paint to save my life, but I wondered if I went into a series of sessions with a deliberate intent to see what ayahuasca could teach me about the possibility of writing fiction, whether something useful would come out of it. And extraordinarily, in a series of sessions back in, I think it was 2006 or possibly 2007, I was just given a very intense, this was five sessions over 2 weeks, I was given a very intense teaching, which basically told me that I had to write the book that became Entangled. And it gave me the scenario that there were two young women, one living 24,000 years ago in the Stone Age, one living in modern Los Angeles, whose destinies, whose fates were literally entangled across time. And that time is not an arrow, it's not a straight line that goes from, you know, past to future, that it's a tangle, a series of knots, a cat's cradle, and that it's possible to intervene in time. And there, this gave me the basic plot for what became my first novel. And I saw scenes, I envisaged scenes. I learned something about the Neanderthals who feature in my novel. When I'd written about the Neanderthals in Supernatural, my previous nonfiction book, I painted them as dull and ignorant savages, knuckle draggers, as the typical stereotype of Neanderthals. But what ayahuasca showed me was they weren't that way. They were filled with love and light, and they communicated telepathically, and we've completely misunderstood them. And so I felt compelled to put that aspect into the story as well. So it gave me the launching pad. It gave me the framework. It gave me the inspiration. But of course, it didn't take away from the hard work. I still had to sit down and write the book, and the book continued to surprise me as I wrote it. But I'm very certain that I would never have written it if I hadn't had those ayahuasca sessions, which I approached with the intention of seeing what I could do in the realm of fiction.
That's very interesting. One of the things I know about a lot of writers is that they often have dreams that, for fiction writers, they'll have dreams and try to incorporate those dreams into their stories.
Yeah.
And it's a similar approach in that you can't do that with nonfiction, but with fiction, you can translate any sort of visionary experience into a story a little easier than with nonfiction.
Absolutely right. I think that this whole process of creativity is really intriguing. It's one of the reasons why I don't prepare an outline when I'm writing a novel. I don't want to be creatively bound by something that I've made when I wasn't in the creative flow. Mm-hmm. I would rather start out with the germ of an idea and just start putting words down there and seeing what comes. I think there's a huge realm of the unconscious that is at play, particularly in writing fiction. And I think the more we allow that unconscious, unthought through aspect of our creativity to emerge, the more we set that free, the better result we're going to end up with.
Yeah, very true.
And that's true of dreams. I mean, dreams are part of that. I've often made this point, you know, that our society is a society that despises dreams. Mm-hmm. If we want to insult somebody, we call them a dreamer. As a matter of fact, that's what my teachers used to call me when I was at school, much to the annoyance of my parents when they received the termly reports, you know, that Hancock is a dreamer. But of course, in ancient times, dreaming was regarded as a very valuable form of knowledge.
Yeah.
It was regarded as a means to gain access to truth. Not every dream, but within the network of dreams that one experiences, there are certain ones that are true tellings. And I believe it was in the Odyssey where a distinction was made between dreams that come through the gate of horn and dreams that come through the gate of ivory. And the dreams that come through the gate of ivory are just, they're just fantastical creations of your mind. But the dreams that come through the gate of horn are true tellings. And the trick is to learn the difference between the two and pay attention to the true tellings.
That's right. That brings us to our next question as well. The issue of this, the theme of this issue is related more towards the occult and the esoteric, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
In a lot of occult and esoteric thinkers, they prescribe practices where, in modern parlance, it's called lucid dreaming, but that they believe that there is a way to enter the other gate consciously in dreams to actually fetch real information.
Yes.
Real, you know, rather than something that's made up.
Yeah.
The theme of this issue is the occult and dark fiction. So I'm wondering what other fiction authors that you like and which have inspired your fiction, especially any authors who might incorporate any of these occult or esoteric ideas in their work.
Sure. Hey, I love Stephen King.
Me too.
A master, yeah. An absolute master of the craft. There's a man who reaches deep into the unconscious and just every time, you know, comes up with the goods, you know, with incredible professionalism and productivity, and just utterly convincing books. I've just recently reread The Stand, except I've read the latest version of The Stand, which is considerably longer than the original version, and it's a masterpiece. It's an absolute masterpiece. I had no sense that I was reading a 1,200 page book, you know, it just, or something like that. I read it on Kindle, so I don't know exactly, but it, you know, I'm told that it's about 1,200 pages, and I just raced through it and loved every minute, and felt annoyed when I had to be taken away from it. So that's a great writer at work, and he is going to be recognized hundreds of years from now. I believe. I mean, okay, so he writes in the horror genre. So what? Why does the horror genre in any way have to be regarded as inferior? We have some great writers in the past who've written incredible horror, and Stephen King is doing that, but with depth and with style, in a way that I think nobody else can really match. Of course, J.R.R. Tolkien, who could miss him out? And there are definite elements of horror in what Tolkien investigates and explores. Mm-hmm. I've never understood why George R.R. Martin has the same initials, but I really enjoy the whole Game of Thrones series, and I read those first as novels before I watched it on TV. Although I think they've done a reasonable job on TV actually with that.
Yeah.
And then a British writer called Joe Abercrombie. Mm-hmm. Who is a fantasy adventure writer. And again, elements of his work definitely cross over into horror. And he's a very powerful, very convincing, very engaging writer as well. So see, these are some of the modern writers that I like, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up Stephen King, because what you said about characterization, I feel he's very good at creating characters that just seem to feel alive. And he seems to do it with ease.
Yeah. With ease, yeah. And you know, I think that there we're looking at an incredibly gifted individual. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, human beings have different mm-hmm. gifts, and some people have got the storytelling gift, and no doubt he's got it. An incredibly gifted individual, but accompanied by a very really powerful professionalism, where the work is done with great rigor and care, no doubt he works extremely fast, but he's been exercising those muscles for so long that the result is just almost always incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And his characters are great, and I can think of few modern writers who've got the same feeling for dialogue that he has, and the way he does the American voice is just absolutely brilliant.
You often highlight...
Or I should say American voices.
Right.
Because he's very good at the regions as well, you know, getting the nuances of different accents. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, he gets the different dialects very well and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You often highlight the supernatural, including supernatural abilities, in your fiction. And indeed, the fiction model allows for more freedom in this regard over nonfiction, as we've discussed. To what extent do you actually believe in the existence of such forces? What is the relation to your view on the subject? What is the relation of your views on this subject in comparison to those of occultists and esotericists who have written about these for the past several hundred years and fully taken the view that these are genuine forces and abilities that people or initiates or whatever you want to call them can cultivate?
Mm. Yeah, I think that area of reality that we... call the supernatural is very real. I don't think it's a fantasy. I don't think it's something that people have made up either out of superstition or wish fulfillment. I think reality is very complicated and mysterious. We are physical beings. We live in a physical material realm. We have five physical senses. And most of the time we are tuned in to material reality, and our laws of physics, our explanations of how the world works, are based on that physical reality. But there are certain things that happen which can't be explained by the laws of physics, and those are defined as supernatural. Now, materialist scientists, those who believe that everything can be reduced to matter, and that there's nothing else of any importance in the universe, because that's their reference frame, they have to persuade themselves that there is no such thing as the supernatural, that it's just stuff people make up. But I think they couldn't be more wrong in that, as in many other matters. I mean, a point I often make is that materialist science, people like Richard Dawkins, author of The Selfish Gene or The God Delusion, for example, will tell you straight-faced that there is no such thing as life after death. You know, but they can't possibly know that. That's not a scientific statement of fact. It's not based on empirical studies or surveys. We don't know what happens after death is a truthful answer. We don't know whether we are non-physical conscious entities temporarily incarnated in physical form or whether the physical form is all there is to us. There's no facts in this area. There's only ideas, philosophies, and speculation. I happen to be strongly of the conclusion, and I prefer to put it in this way, that reality is just much more complicated than we can easily imagine, and that we are presently tuned into and interacting with a very tiny slice of reality. And our society strongly conditions us to interact with that tiny slice of reality and seeks to persuade us that it is all there is to reality, perhaps because it would be profoundly destabilizing for our society if more and more people were to realize that that is not the case. Now, what's brought this home to me is my work with psychedelics, and particularly with ayahuasca, over the last dozen years or so. That's really, it's about a dozen years, since 2003, that I began to investigate this area carefully. And I would, first of all, I would challenge any hardened materialist skeptic who claims that there is no parallel realms, that there is no other dimensions, that this is all there is. I would challenge such a person, go down to the Amazon, have a dozen sessions of ayahuasca, and then review your opinion. Let's see whether you are still of the same opinion or not. And compare notes with other people who've drunk ayahuasca, and you may find that they are meeting the same entities and exploring the same landscapes. And this is generally when a large number of people agree on the nature of certain experiences, those experiences are, we conclude they're real. Right. And that's what's happening with altered states of consciousness and the realms that they appear to open up to us, is that there's enough transpersonal work now to say it appears that we have a freestanding alternate reality out there, maybe many. And instead of dismissing it as mumbo jumbo and superstition, we should actually be devoting some of the resources of our science and society to exploring that. I actually think it would be a much more effective use of NASA's money. I'm not saying that NASA are wrong to go searching for life on other planets, but I think they could have very intriguing results if they were to go within as well and do targeted research projects with substances like dimethyltryptamine, which alter consciousness very radically, and to see what comes out of those. One of the passages I remember and sometimes quote from the work of Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico in the 1990s with dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and human volunteers, is that several of those volunteers encountered entities who said to them, and this is really intriguing, they all said the same thing. They said, "We're so pleased you've discovered this technology. Now we can communicate with you more easily." Imagine that there might be whole other dimensions and that all we need to do to access them is to alter the receiver wavelength of the brain. Maybe that's what's happening with hallucinogens, with particularly a substance like DMT, that it is changing the channel and allowing us to access other levels of reality that are normally closed off to us. And those are the other levels of reality that are called the supernatural. So many people have supernatural experiences, but they tend to be random. You tend not to be able to predict when they will happen. They're very elusive. They're very hard to test. With dimethyltryptamine, you have the opportunity to put people into a state of mind where they will have supernatural experiences, absolutely for sure, and where you can test those experiences and you can compare notes between different volunteers. So I think we're dealing with a complex, multi-layered, nuanced reality. And I take the view of shamans and the view of ancient Gnosticism as well, which is that this nuanced and usually invisible, these nuanced and usually invisible levels of reality are interacting with us whether we like it or not, and that it's better if we are proactive and rather than be the victim of those forces, that we seek to negotiate with them on equal terms. And that's what shamans do. Shamans are not in terror of spirits. Shamans are the masters of spirits. Their whole life training has been to become that. And I just think that there's a lot that we in the West could learn from that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've read in some cases where they talk about in order for spirits to manifest to people, they have to descend, so to speak, into like imaginative pictures.
Yeah.
But that's difficult for them, so that when a human being can do something like take ayahuasca, which raises them up a few levels, they don't have to then descend as far, and it's like a more complementary meeting.
That makes perfect sense to me. That's what it feels like. It feels like suddenly the air clears, mm-hmm. and we're communicating with intelligences that have always been there, mm-hmm. But the air's been so foggy we haven't been able to encounter them at a conscious level before. Of course, I can't prove that that's the case, but I think that our society has not yet done the work that it could do to test this hypothesis out, and that if it were to do that work at the same sort of level that we're putting into the exploration of outer space, then we might get some very intriguing results. Very intriguing results.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, the next question has quite a long lead in here. We're going to talk about your most recent fiction books, which are part of a larger series, which are War God, Knights of the Witch, and War God II, Return of the Plumed Serpent. They take place during the Spanish conquest of the New World, with Cortez and his men conquering the Aztec Empire. In regards to your nonfiction writing, your work has often been viewed as dealing with fringe academia or even rogue scholarship. But for this next question, I propose we fully leave the constraints of the academic world and enter fully into the world of occult sciences. Some occultists in the past have discussed the idea that human sacrifice among the Aztecs was the worst form of black magic, a leftover from the darker side of the lost continent of Atlantis. There's a lecture that was given in 1916 by the German mystic and occultist Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Atlantean Impulses of the Mexican Mysteries, in which he discusses an idea that after the destruction of Atlantis, several survivors of the lost continent went east to India and China, bearing the sacred vowels Tao, as in Taoism, which was considered to be the great spirit of Atlantis. Conversely, other survivors went west to the Americas, bearing a corrupted version of the same vowel set, namely Teotl, traces of which can be found in names such as the deities Quetzalcoatl. According to Steiner, the Atlantean descendants who went to the east continued to propagate the process of reincarnation and repeated earth lives, while in the Americas, the Mexican mysteries required that a candidate for initiation commit a murder, and they were working to drive souls away from reincarnating on this planet through ritual sacrifice. Of course, this was not the case of all the Mexican mysteries, but particularly of the Aztec, which you write about a lot in your two books. So, and you employ, in both of your books, you employ the imagery of human sacrifice quite vividly. That was one of the things that struck me the most when I was reading through the first War God.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk about, in your own opinion, what forces do you believe are at play or were at play in those situations? Not just trying to appease the god per se, but maybe even psychologically,
mm-hmm.
or what exactly was going on there?
Yeah, you know, this comes down to the fundamental issue of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly good and evil in this physical realm. The earth, the world that we live in, some might say that these are all social constructs. I don't happen to agree with that. I think that there is fundamental good and fundamental evil. Just as those, in fact, a friend of mine, James Tipton, speaks of this physical world as a university of duality. That we're here to be taught by the choices we make between good and evil, between darkness and light. That's what defines us. That's why it's an incredible privilege to be born in a human body, rather than, for example, a cockroach or a fruit fly. We've got the equipment to make very fine distinctions. And I would propose that we are actually all making those distinctions all the time. Sometimes it's at a very small level. in the case of, you know, the average individual, most of the time, the choice is between good and evil, maybe between small goods and small evils. And sometimes it's at a massive level where you have national leaders who are making choices between good and evil, and those choices may plunge millions into darkness or offer the possibility of light for millions as well. But it's a continuum. At the bottom of it is the process of choosing, always choosing, because we always have that. Even in the most extreme, difficult circumstances, human beings always have choice. We don't have to do something wicked. We can choose not to do that. And if we do something wicked, I would say it is a choice, which, in one way or another, in the longer term scheme of things, we will be required to account for. That happens to be my personal belief system. The ancient Egyptians visualized it as the weighing of the soul. There are the scales of Maat, the goddess of cosmic justice and harmony. And in one scale is a symbol of the soul of the deceased, represents his heart, actually. And in the other scale is the feather of truth and justice. And in the ancient Egyptian system, they were tolerant. They understood human frailty. But the notion of life is that, yes, we make mistakes. We need not face eternal damnation, as the Catholics would say, for making a moral error. But we have long enough in life to put that right, to not repeat mistakes that we've made, to learn our lessons, and to balance the scale in other ways with acts of goodness and light. And I think there's a fundamental truth in that. I think that a human life is like a work of art. And at the end of it, you should be able to knock off a few corners here and there, do some damage to your work of art, but also perfect aspects of it. And at the end of it, you should be able to stand and look back on it. Overall, on balance, I did good. And that is the fundamental choice we make. Well, there's good and evil in this realm, and there's good and evil in all other realms as well. In the so-called supernatural realms, in the parallel dimensions that interact with our dimension, as I said, whether we like it or not. So when you go on a psychedelic journey, particularly with something like ayahuasca, you are not only going to encounter, you know, beautiful glowing goddesses. You are also going to encounter demons. You are going to encounter psychic vampires whose entire purpose is to just suck out your life force and leave you drained and empty. And that's why it's no joke to undertake an ayahuasca session. You have to gird yourself psychically for the challenges that you will face. Not everybody faces them, not all the time, but most people do if they do enough sessions. And again, you find yourself confronted by choice. Now, I think that certain cultures in the past made deliberate choices for darkness, and perhaps they sought to be empowered by doing so. Yes, the Aztecs carried out the most ghastly human sacrifices. The evidence is that they took great pleasure in doing it, that they approached it with a kind of lust, that they humiliated their victims on their way up the steps of the pyramid, and that they dressed them up in ridiculous clothes and daubed them with rubber and feathers to make them look foolish. They really were reveling in the suffering and pain that they caused before the act of human sacrifice took place. And the act of human sacrifice was definitely about stealing the energy, stealing the light, stealing the soul of that person. So it's the ultimate act of intruding on another person's sovereignty is involved in the act of human sacrifice. Let's call it what it is. It's murder. The act of murder is the ultimate intrusion on another human being's sovereign space. It's taking that away from them for your own benefit, you suppose. I believe there are checks and balances in the universe that would not ultimately allow people to benefit from such actions. But in the short term, they might benefit. The Aztecs used human sacrifice as a way of terrorizing their neighbors. This was how they kept them under control. They would stage displays. They would bring chiefs of neighboring tribes who might be becoming a bit disruptive, and they would sit them down and they would carry out grotesque human sacrifices, skinning people alive, for example, cutting out their hearts in front of them. And the message was, you know, if you cross us, this is what's going to happen to you and to your young people and to your men and women and children. So don't cross us. Now, the interesting thing is that by doing that, yes, the Aztecs did rise to power, but look what happened. When Cortez turned up on the coast of Mexico, huge numbers of people already hated the Aztecs. They hated them and feared them so much that when Cortez came with just 400 men and a promise that he would overthrow the Aztec hegemony, many local tribes joined him. If the Aztecs had behaved, ultimately the security that the Aztecs thought they were buying with these ritual acts turned out to be illusory. It turned out, in fact, to be the reason for their destruction, because Cortez alone could never have defeated the Aztecs. He needed the local auxiliaries that he had. So there was a direct karmic relationship there. But this is not to say that Cortez is a good guy, because Cortez, you know, was a very bad guy in many, many, many ways. One of the interesting things for me about writing the War God series is getting inside Cortez's head and seeing how this man progresses through his life and how he becomes steadily. He starts out as a rather cheerful, slightly immoral adventurer, and he ends up just plunged in darkness and cruelty. He's immersed himself up to the elbows in blood, and he at the end of it, he's a poisoned, tortured spirit in my view. Now consider what the Spanish did when they burned people at the stake. You know, we tend to say, oh, the Aztecs, they were murderous savages. They cut out people's hearts and carried out acts of human sacrifice. Well, burning somebody at the stake is an act of human sacrifice. That's what the Spanish were doing, too. They were also feeding the dark side. And the irony is they said they were doing it for a god who was good. That's what makes it even worse, you know, that they were, what they were actually doing, they're taking a human being, tying that person to a stake, and lighting flames under them. Imagine the state of mind it takes to put another human being in that place to do that, to inflict that level of horrific suffering on another human being. The Spanish did it lightly, lightheartedly. They just were ready to burn at the stake. And in so doing, I maintain, they were carrying out acts of human sacrifice and seeking to energize the dark side of themselves, which they absolutely did. So, you know, this is a realm in which good and evil are found on both sides. One of the things in telling the story for me has been to find those characters who redeem the story, who even in the darkest situation, the darkest setting, the most awful things are going on around them, find the capacity for love, find the capacity for principled courage, and act upon it. And that's the beauty of humanity, that we have all this complexity. We have an incredible capacity for wickedness and evil, and we have an amazing capacity for good and for love and for decency as well. And those capacities, I believe, cross all realms and all realities.
Yeah, the two female characters in the first book seem to portray that very well, I felt.
Yeah, that's my intention. They have their own dark sides, and part of their story is, you know, moving through that and how they evolve as characters as well.
So I'm interested if you could, this is something I didn't know that well until I read your book, but that ethnogens such as psilocybin and ayahuasca were used during these ritual sacrifices.
Right, not ayahuasca. Not in Mexico. Ayahuasca is a South American brew. The plants out of which ayahuasca is made are indigenous to the Amazon jungle, and they're not found in Central America at all. But what is found in plentiful supply in Central America is the psilocybin mushrooms. And again, this shows that with powerful psychedelics, the intention you bring to the experience is at least as important as the substance itself, because psilocybin can be used in very positive light-bringing ceremonies, and it can be an incredible liberating influence in people's lives. It so happened that that's not the way the Aztecs used psilocybin. They used psilocybin mushrooms to connect with demonic entities, and they frequently, the sacrifices would frequently have consumed psilocybin mushrooms before they embarked upon the grisly act of cutting out hundreds of living people's hearts in honor of their so-called deity. So here we have a powerful vehicle for transforming consciousness, and the way that it transforms consciousness and the direction in which it transforms consciousness doesn't reside in the vehicle itself. It resides in the individual who's using it and the choices that that individual makes, a bit like electricity. You know, electricity can be used for wonderful, positive things, but it can also kill people. And I would say that the powerful entheogens are like that. The state of mind that you bring to the party is a crucial part of what will happen. And you can invoke the dark side, and some people definitely do. And I said ayahuasca was not known in Central America, and that's true. But in South America, where ayahuasca is known, it isn't only used for the light. The ayahuasqueros who I like to work with are the curanderos, the healers. They're using it for healing. But there are brujos, there are sorcerers, there are men and women who are using ayahuasca, the vulnerability that ayahuasca brings, the access to, if you like, supernatural powers that ayahuasca brings. They're using that to gain control over others, to infringe upon the sovereignty of others, to take everything away from other people. And this is something that the West should be aware of as we expand our relationship with ayahuasca. And that's going very fast at the moment. You can drink ayahuasca in most industrialized cities now. Ceremonies are available under the radar, but they're there. Nobody should imagine that it's all sweetness and light in that garden. It's not. I happen to believe that there is a powerful entity of love behind the ayahuasca brew. And in the West, we tend to call her Mother Ayahuasca. It's like an encounter with a goddess. I mean, any down-to-earth materialist hearing me say this will immediately conclude that Hancock is mad, you know, and they're welcome to that view. But I say again, go to the Amazon, have 12 sessions with ayahuasca, see if you still feel the same way. And I have seen situations in ceremony where people have encountered this entity. I've encountered her myself. And have received fundamental healings as a result of that encounter, and fundamental changes of mind, which alter the whole rest of the course of your life in extremely positive ways. But I've also seen darkness come down in ceremony, and people seized and possessed by something very negative. I call them psychic vampires. And in fact, I attended such a ceremony with a friend of mine, and we both experienced dramatic and terrifying effects, which affected the whole group. And Mother Ayahuasca appeared to my friend and said, "You needed to see this. Now you understand what I have to deal with all the time." And there's a strange vulnerability in a goddess there. It's as though whatever they are, these entities are not all powerful. They manifest in the material realm by affecting human consciousness. And some of them affect human consciousness very negatively, and some of them affect it very positively. So we must be strong when we go into that experience. And ideally, we should be guided by a good-hearted person, a facilitator, a shaman, who absolutely knows what he or she is doing and who is not driven by ego. My advice to anybody seeking out ayahuasca, finding ayahuasca ceremonies in the West or in the Amazon, is gain knowledge of the shaman who's going to be offering you that brew. Because if there's any hint of a personality cult around that person, run away. Get away from it as far as you possibly can. What you're drinking ayahuasca for is the lessons that the medicine has to teach, not the lessons that some human being has to teach. We don't need gurus in this area.
Right. Very good advice. So both Cortez and Montezuma were in contact with divine intelligences in your book, St. Peter.
Or demonic intelligences.
Or demonic, right?
Yes.
And the appearance of Cortez was seen by many as the return of the plumed serpent Quetzalcoatl.
Indeed, and he took advantage of that.
Right, and even this reappearance had been anticipated by them. So it would seem, whether or not this was all psychological or not, it would seem that there were outside forces at play on all sides of this, and people were receiving inspiration.
Very extraordinary what happened and what went down. First of all, in terms of those, let's call them spiritual encounters, the notion that I play with in the War God series of novels is that the same demonic entity that these are shapeshifters, that manifests to Moctezuma in the form of the god of war, Hummingbird, they called him Huitzilopochtli, takes another appearance, takes another disguise, and appears to Cortez in the form of St. Peter. But actually, it's all one demon. And he's doing what demons have always done throughout human history, which is to seek to maximize confusion and chaos and misery in the world. Cortez may imagine he's talking to some saintly guide, but actually what he's talking to is a demon who is driving him on to ever more wicked acts as he goes along the journey. Sorry, the second part of your question was?
Let's see here. Well, one part of it that I didn't quite get to, I was wondering, is this factual? Is this something you employed more intuitively in your books, or is this in a factual?
No, it's factual. The notion that Cortez's dream encounters with St. Peter were really encounters with a demon, that's me. That's my suggestion. But right. Cortez, from his childhood, believed himself to have been inspired by St. Peter and had frequent encounters with the entity that he construed to be St. Peter in the realm of dreams. He was reportedly saved from a fatal childhood illness by the intervention of St. Peter, and ever afterwards St. Peter was his patron saint. Likewise, Moctezuma, we know from the historical annals, felt himself to be in regular contact with Hummingbird, the god of war, that contact was absolutely facilitated by eating what they called the flesh of the gods, Teonanactyl, the psilocybin mushrooms, that he would enter a trance state, and in that trance state he would encounter this entity who gave him incredibly bad advice and always wanted him to conduct more murders, to feed him the souls of more sacrificial victims. There's a definite historical basis to both of these types of encounters, but the construal that I put on them is my own, of course.
Right, as well as the idea that he was the return of Quetzalcoatl.
There's something really strange. You see, there was a prophecy of the return of Quetzalcoatl. To summarize it briefly, there was in Mexico a classic battle between good and evil that was remembered as having unfolded in the distant past. There had been a deity in human form, who they called Quetzalcoatl. The Maya called him Gucumatz. It means the feathered serpent, the plumed serpent. He had been a god of peace. He forbade human sacrifice. He enjoined people to sacrifice only fruits and flowers, never to take a human life, and ushered in what is remembered as a golden age and a reign of peace. But then there came a conspiracy of evil against him. Demonic entities, Hummingbird amongst them, who sought the overthrow of Quetzalcoatl and who succeeded and who drove him out of Mexico. And he is said to have sailed from the coast of the Gulf of Mexico at a place called Coatzacoalcos, which means the serpent sanctuary. He's said to have sailed from there on a raft made of serpents. It's very peculiar. But as he went, he promised that one day he would return. And when he did so, he would come back with others, and they would be in boats that moved by themselves without paddles, and that they would return to Mexico and they would overthrow the rule of evil and bring back the rule of peace, and that this would happen at a particular date in the Mexican calendar, which was the year one reed. They called it the year one reed. They had year names. And this was to be the year one read. And it's a very bizarre thing that the exact moment that Cortes landed in Mexico, 1519, was the beginning of the Aztec year one read. So he fulfilled an undoubtedly real existing ancient prophecy, and he looked the part. He came in ships that moved by themselves without paddles, sails. Aztecs had never seen sails before. He was equipped with all kinds of weaponry that they'd never seen and never understood. There was a particular weapon that they was spoken of in the ancient traditions of Mexico as a fire serpent, which would, bolts of fire would come out of it. It would dismember human beings. It was a terrible, powerful weapon. And the Spanish had fire serpents. Of course, we call them guns. So many other aspects of the Spanish were mysterious and supernatural. The very fact they rode horses, only 16 horses amongst the whole Cortes army, 16 heavy horse. But, you know, my God, 16 heavy horse coming down on you at 30 miles an hour, men on their backs, armored in steel, the horses themselves armored in steel, the ground shaking under their feet. There were very few indigenous Central American armies that could bear that sight. They felt they were confronting gods, this terrible supernatural beings. For quite a while, they really weren't clear that this was men mounted on the back of animals. They thought they were dealing with some kind of hybrid entity. Eventually, that myth was punctured. But that was their first notion, so they were, you know, hugely at a psychological disadvantage. It really looked like the fulfillment of prophecy, and Cortes cynically, calculatedly took advantage of that. That was, you know, Cortes was a Machiavellian player. His principle was anything that works. If I can use something that'll work for me, I will use it. And he saw that he could use that, and he cleverly did use it. It's not that he ever pretended to be a god, but he allowed that superstition amongst the Aztecs to grow to massive levels, so that Moctezuma, the first time Cortes and Moctezuma actually met face to face, Moctezuma was literally shaking in his sandals, you know, like all bullies, you know, put to the test. He proved to be a complete coward. And Cortes had just played mind games with him for months and months and months before that, to the point where the man just crumbled. It's a fascinating episode to explore, actually.
Yeah, there's such a large amount of synchronicity there that it would seem, you couldn't really call it random. It would seem like all.
I don't think so. Yeah. I think there's something, you know, something deeper and darker at work in all of this, because we shouldn't forget that in many ways, the monstrous course that the world is set upon today had its beginnings in the Spanish conquest of Mexico. So many negative things came out of that. It suddenly was okay, you know, the Spanish set the example. So it was just okay to go and take other people's countries. Very few years afterwards, Pizarro went off to Peru with even less men than Cortes had and followed the Cortes model and pulled off the same trick. And then you have the genocide of Native American Indians in North America. Again, it all goes back, I believe, to that time where Cortes got away with it. And it came to be seen as something that, you know, the white nations could do to the nations that they encountered. How different it would have been if Moctezuma had not been hated by all his neighbors, and if they had stopped the Spanish invasion on the beach before they came any further. How much that would have required the Spanish to rethink their strategy and perhaps to operate in a different way. Who knows the direction the world might have gone in? We might have ended up where these two very different cultures approached one another in a spirit of seeking to learn from one another rather than seeking to master one another. But it went down the way it went down, and our world today is a product of what happened between 1519 and 1521.
Yeah, definitely. And even when you're describing this idea of them seeing the horsemen as gods and then over time slowly realizing that it's, you know, two different beings, one's riding the other.
Yeah.
That in itself makes me think that that's a materialization of their thought processes, of seeing something as a god and suddenly having to realize that it's not. That has a materializing effect on their overall state of consciousness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. It definitely does. And that's a, you know, that's an interesting aspect of this, of what happened to the state of consciousness of both parties to this epic struggle at the time that the struggle unfolded.
Right, and now consciousness seems to be streaming out from the West and in the Americas now, particularly all across the world. That kind of consciousness it's being taken up by other countries.
It is. It is indeed. Very interesting to me, though, what's happening in America at the moment. Because, at one level, the United States is the heart of the power structure. It's the heart of the Western technological power structure that dominates the world. But at the other level, at the level of individual Americans, something very different is happening. I sense a huge awakening in America taking place. And this may be regarded by some as a trivial example, but I regard it as a very important example, which is state by state, marijuana is being decriminalized. It's being made legal. You know, we've had 40 plus years of propaganda from the war on drugs. We've been beaten about the head, lied to. Millions of people have had their lives ruined, have been sent to prison. What for smoking cannabis? Utterly absurd. And America has driven this process, this so-called war on drugs, all around the world. So it's very pleasant for me, as an observer, to see that it is Americans, individual Americans, state by state, who are winding that in and who are refusing to allow that shit to go on any longer. You know, I was just very recently in Colorado, and I really value and appreciate what's happening there. Adults are actually being treated as adults. If we choose to smoke or imbibe cannabis in some other way, that's our free choice. There's no policeman going to come and break down our door and ruin our reputation and send us to prison for so doing. And it's not only Colorado. It's Oregon. It's Washington State. It's Alaska. It's medical marijuana being legal in, I think, more than 23 states now. The engine of the war on drugs, which had federal America behind it for so long, which caused so much suffering and pain in the world, because the war on drugs is an unremittingly evil enterprise, in my view, that is being stopped by Americans at the grassroots level, just the way Americans at the grassroots level stopped the Vietnam War. So America has there's great power in the population where when the people wake up, they can really change things. That can't happen in Britain. You can't imagine, you know, Yorkshire or Northumberland deciding to legalize cannabis. It would never happen, but it does happen in America, and it's setting an example to the rest of the world.
Yeah, there is something very interesting in the way this country was set up and founded. And even though it has all this dark stuff going on, there's also something underlying the entire structure that really allows for consciousness to change and to
really, yeah,
yeah. So it's a very that, yeah, that in itself is a very interesting.
It really does. It's something very special about America. I think in this respect, America is actually unique in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a new awakening taking place. And I think that right down at the individual, at the grassroots level, Americans are leading that new awakening, and it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to switch gears here for our last couple questions. In your TED Talks event that was booted off YouTube, you commented that the main illness that people are facing is the loss, in the West, I think you said, is the loss of the connection with the higher spiritual realms, and that ayahuasca could act as a remedy for that illness. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, and just how could ayahuasca be used for good in this regard, as opposed to the negative way, such as was used with the Aztecs?
Well, let's repeat. The Aztecs never used ayahuasca.
Right, they used psilocybin.
They used psilocybin, right. But ayahuasca is used in negative ways by some individuals in the world today, and even in its homeland, the Amazon. Mm-hmm. What this notion that you began your question with, it isn't my notion. This is what shamans in the Amazon have said to me, that the problem with the West, and they're very aware of the problem. You shouldn't imagine that people living in the Amazon jungle are out of touch with what's happening in the world. They're not. They know what's going on in the world. And their diagnosis, their analysis is that the fundamental problem with Western technological society, which includes societies in the East like Korea and Japan, you know, let's just call it technological society, that the fundamental problem with technological societies is that they have severed their connection with spirit, that we have immersed ourselves too deeply in materialism, both in terms of the way we live our lives, that we define ourselves in terms of production and consumption, but also in terms of the basic philosophy that there is nothing else to reality except the material realm. that there is no spiritual dimension to life. This is a very strong view amongst intellectuals in technological societies, that there is no such thing as a spirit. From the shamanic perspective, this is a very dangerous view, and it explains why so much harm and damage is being done around the world by technological societies. And that's why what I call a kind of reverse missionary activity is underway. And it's why shamans from the heart of the Amazon are willing to even take risks with the law and to come to Western countries and to offer ceremony and to train up Westerners with ayahuasca, because they know that ayahuasca can give you such a powerful kick up the ass that it will make you think again about everything. Always used with the right intent. That's very, very important issue in this. But if it's used with the right intent, in the right way, with experienced hands, responsibly, with love, with care, it can completely change one's outlook on life. And that's why I've often said, I think, I've said it about materialist scientists, and I say it about politicians too. If I had the power to implement this, I would say that anyone running for presidential office, anyone running to be prime minister of a country, fine, run for it. But first, a dozen ayahuasca sessions. Have those sessions, then run. That's the, you know, that is the threshold obligation that you must meet in order to run for power. I suspect quite a lot of them actually wouldn't want to run for power anymore.
Right.
And those who do, I think many of them would operate in different ways. And that's what shamans feel. And that's why fundamentally what we need in technological societies is that huge kick up the ass. We got to stop being so complacent. We got to stop feeling that all the answers to all the problems come from technology. This is why I have a problem with transhumanism. You know, the idea that we're going to manipulate the human genome, that we're going to introduce all kinds of technological solutions which will make human beings live for hundreds of years and do so in a healthy physical form. That all sounds very desirable, and it may be. But unless we solve the spiritual problems first, unless we address our spiritual darkness, unless we address the dearth of real spiritual connection in Western society, it's a waste of time to do any of that. We're putting the cart before the horse. Yeah, technology is great. Yes, we can use it for wonderful things. But if we haven't got our heads straight first, then the outcome will not be wonderful, in my view. So I would say transhumanism is being used as yet another reason to ignore the spiritual dimension of life and to concentrate entirely on physical enhancements. Mm-hmm. And those physical enhancements, in my view, are a waste of time if they are not accompanied by spiritual enhancement as well. And I happen to believe, from my own experiences, from deep research into the subject, from my connections with many, many people around the globe who've worked with ayahuasca, that ayahuasca, used right, used responsibly, can do that.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring up transhumanism. The last issue of Dark Discoveries, we had a theme. The theme of that issue was transhumanism. Mm-hmm. And in that issue, a couple of the articles discussed the idea that if humanity is waking up, can wake up on its own, maybe through the use of certain plants and that sort of thing, but eventually we'll wake up to the spiritual world on its own through an evolutionary process. Whereas the counterpart to that, which would even be seem to be working against it, is this idea that we can do it technologically and have a one ego. That doesn't even, you know, even if there's something in like reincarnation, if you sustain your ego here definitely, that takes out the idea of reincarnation.
Yeah, that's another reason that I have a problem with it, because I happen to believe in reincarnation. And actually, if you go into the studies, it's a little bit beyond belief. I mean, it's not just a matter of belief. There is powerful evidence that reincarnation occurs. So, you know, what happens? Mysterious reality has come up with something that's a much better trick than transhumanism, that we can have multiple lives, experience many different, learn and grow as souls and spirits in many different incarnations and many different ways. And from that point of view, it would be a really bad idea to live in the same body for hundreds and hundreds of years in the same circumstances. What you need is to shuffle the deck and come back in totally different circumstances. Maybe you were a billionaire in this life. Maybe it's really good for your spirit in the next life to be born a pauper. And to have to wrestle with that and deal with that, you know, that's what reincarnation offers, which transhumanism appears to be seeking to take away. So I have no problem with technology as such, but we have to do the spiritual work first, and that should guide our approach to technology. It shouldn't be the other way around. And I'm afraid the mainstream religions, again, this is my opinion, the mainstream religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam in particular, I don't think that they offer a format to do that spiritual work. The spiritual work has to be at the level of direct personal experience.
Definitely. For the last question, I want to talk about your new book that's coming out.
Yeah.
In the 1990s, your writing career really got kickstarted with Fingerprints of the Gods, which was a big success and received a lot of different reactions from the public and academia. The book posits the birth of human civilization is far older than conventional historians would have us believe, and also that there is a connection to a now long forgotten advanced culture.
Yeah.
Now 20 years later, you're about to release the sequel to that book, which is entitled Magicians of the Gods. I'm interested in what this book is about, how it functions as a sequel, and I'm also interested in the Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if you're going to be using that in the book, but if you are, that's
certainly the opening chapters are about Göbekli Tepe.
Very cool.
Göbekli Tepe is a very mysterious archaeological site in southeastern Turkey, which has completely revolutionized our understanding of history. And that site was not discovered when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. It's one of the reasons that I'm writing a sequel. To be clear, this new book, Magicians of the Gods, is not an update of Fingerprints of the Gods. It's not an update at all. It's a completely new book from front to back, filled with new evidence and new travels to places I didn't talk about before, as well as to some places that I did talk about before, but with a new perspective. And one of the key new sites is Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. What happened was that in 1996, a German archaeologist called Professor Klaus Schmidt from the German Archaeological Institute came across a site that 20 years earlier had been surveyed and dismissed by a couple of other archaeologists. They dismissed it because there were very fine bits of carved stone sticking out of the ground, and the work was so good that they concluded they were looking for Stone Age stuff. And they concluded this was Byzantine. It was from the Middle Ages. It wasn't of interest to them. They passed it by. But Klaus Schmidt had some experiences on sites in Turkey, which led him to think again about that. And he went back and took another look at that site and began to excavate it. And what he discovered was a gigantic megalithic complex. It's on the scale of Stonehenge multiplied by 50. It's just a gigantic place. So far, 80 or 90% of it is still under the ground. We know it's there because of ground-penetrating radar. But what they've excavated so far are these circles of gigantic megalithic pillars, with pillars weighing 20 tons and standing 20, 25 feet tall, with precise astronomical alignments and very, very beautifully put together. Now, here's the thing. The dating of that site is absolutely definite. It's very difficult to date stone monuments, actually. Carbon dating won't do it. Carbon dating only dates organic materials. So when an archaeologist tells you that we've carbon dated a site, what they mean is that they found a bit of bone or a bit of charcoal which is associated with the stone object, and they've deduced that the stone object is of the same age as that piece of organic material, and that may not be the case.
Hmm.
What's special about Göbekli Tepe is that whoever made it, whoever mysterious people made it, 10,000 years ago, they deliberately buried it. They covered it in what appears to be a pot-bellied hill. That's what Göbekli Tepe means in the Turkish language. And for 10,000 years, it remained absolutely untouched by the hand of man, sealed away like a time capsule. That's not true of any other megalithic site. You can go to the megalithic temples in Malta, for example, which are thought to be 5,000 or 6,000 years old. And they've been trapped over by every human culture for thousands and thousands of years. And the dating is actually, in my opinion, very insecure on those sites. We may be being misled to give falsely young dates by the introduction of later organic materials to those sites. That didn't happen at Göbekli Tepe. And it allows it allows us to say for sure that this site is in the range of 12,000 years old. It may be significantly older than that. Let's see what else comes out of the ground. But what they've got now, we can be absolutely certain, is 11,600 years old. Now, this is, for those who haven't studied archaeology and history, you might think, well, so what? Well, here's what. Stonehenge, famous megalithic site, is less than 5,000 years old. It's 4,500 years old, according to the mainstream chronology. All of the megalithic monuments, famous ones of Europe, whether in Malta or Menorca or in Brittany in France, for example, or in Spain or in Portugal, they're thought to date to that horizon, 5 to 5,500 years old. Nobody is supposed to have been creating gigantic megalithic sites 6 or 7,000 years earlier than that. Why? Because our ancestors, 11,600, 12,000 years ago, were what they call Upper Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, Old Stone Age hunter-gatherers. They are not supposed to have had the organization or the social structure that is needed to create a large-scale architectural project. It just doesn't fit in to the pattern of history. Secondly, evidence is now compelling that at the same time that Göbekli Tepe was being made, whoever made it, they also, quote-unquote, invented agriculture. Suddenly, agriculture appears in southeastern Turkey, at the same time that monumental architecture suddenly appears. And to me, the interesting issue is, what is really going on here? Did a bunch of hunter-gatherers wake up one morning and think, we're just going to create this humongous megalithic site with really, really challenging engineering problems, which we've never encountered before, but we're going to do it brilliantly. And by the way, at the same moment, we're going to invent agriculture. Is that realistic, or are we looking at a transfer of technology? Are we looking at the survivors of a lost civilization who, after a great global cataclysm, settled in Göbekli Tepe and used it as a center of innovation to introduce the notion of settled civilization to the tribes that lived in that area at that time? See, even today, we have a global situation where we have advanced technological cultures coexisting with hunter-gatherer cultures. There are people in the Amazon who don't even know, you know, America exists. They've had no contact with technological society at all. And I believe it was the case 10, 20,000 years ago as well, that there was an advanced civilization on this planet and that there were hunter-gatherers. And the advanced civilization was destroyed. Now, the second thing that is of great importance in the new book, Göbekli Tepe is one of the reasons. There are many other sites now being discovered that don't fit the paradigm. There's an incredible pyramid site in Indonesia called Gunung Padang, which also features prominently in my book. But more important than that, in a way, is that I have now what I didn't have in 1995. And that's a smoking gun. That is the incredible work that's been done in the last 7-8 years by a large group of scientists. There are more than 28 of them who co-author the papers in journals like the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences or the Journal of Geology or the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. And what they've been demonstrating, not without opposition, they have faced opposition from other scientists, but what they've been demonstrating is that our planet was hit by a comet 12,800 years ago. It's taken so long for the evidence for this to come out because there doesn't appear to be an obvious immediate crater. The reason there isn't a crater is the comet broke up into fragments. Some of the fragments were very large, about a mile in diameter, and those large fragments impacted what was then the North American ice cap. North America, roughly from Minneapolis northwards, was covered in ice 2 miles deep. This was the Ice Age. And the impacts were on ice. So the craters were transient. They were formed in 2 mile deep ice. They instantly liquidized that ice. They caused cataclysmic flooding across what are called the channeled scablands of the Columbia Plateau. You can particularly see them in Washington State. And they caused just unbelievable volumes of icy water to be released into the world ocean, disrupting the Gulf Stream when it flew into the Atlantic and the Antarctic Oceans, disrupting the Gulf Stream and changing global climate. Now, geologists have known that something weird happened then. 12,800 years ago is the beginning of a period that geologists call the Younger Dryas. The world appeared to be coming out of the Ice Age, had been for a few thousand years, and then suddenly it goes back into conditions of extreme cold. It now appears that that was because of the comet impacts on the North American ice cap, and that that extreme cold resulted from the disruption of ocean circulation. 1,200 years later, 11,600 years ago, the exact date that Göbekli Tepe appears to have been founded, something else happens. The world suddenly reverses its climate again. The Younger Dryas ends. Global climate shoot up by the order of 10 to 15 degrees in a single lifetime. It's extraordinary what happens. Again, the comet explains this. The broad argument is that we're looking at what is called a giant comet, which had originally a diameter of about 150 miles. This giant comet broke into fragments. 12,800 years ago, about 8 of those fragments hit the Earth, and many small, big fragments and many smaller bits. It was an extinction-level event. This is when the megafauna, the mammoths, the woody rhinos, the giant beavers, and so on and so forth in North America went extinct. 1,200 years later, the Earth encountered the debris stream of the comet again. This time, the impacts were in ocean. They caused a huge cloud of water vapor to be thrown up into the upper atmosphere and created a dramatic global warming, which resulted in the further climate change that took place at that point. And so we have a period of 1,200 years between 12,800 years ago and 11,600 years ago when a previously undetected extinction-level event on the scale of the event that made the dinosaurs extinct happened. Now, previously, scientists used to think extinction-level events, encounters with asteroids and comets on a large size, are very rare. Of course, we encounter meteors all the time, but they're just harmless little firework displays. The big ones, they used to think they happened like every 100 million years. So archaeologists have not been inclined to take them into account in the story of human history. The discovery of this comet impact totally changes all of that. What we are now having to get to grips with is that just yesterday, in historical terms, right at the beginning of the time when the story of civilization that's told to us by historians and archaeologists seems to begin, right then, just before that, there was this incredible punctuation mark. A global cataclysm on an almost unimaginable scale. And suddenly, all the myths and traditions of a lost civilization, of a golden age, global floods and cataclysmic earthquakes, they all make complete sense. And, the point I'm making is that history, for the last 11,600 years, history and archaeology, may have built a pretty good house. But that house has foundations of sand, because they are not taking account of what happened immediately before that. They're not taking account of this extinction level event. So I've written this new book to bring all this evidence, both the archaeological evidence, the mythical evidence, and the evidence concerning the comet, to bring it all together in one place and put it before the general public. And that book's going to be published on the 10th of November 2015 in the United States, a bit earlier in Britain on the 10th of September in Britain, and in Canada on the 3rd of November. But it's all happening in the next few months, and I'm just absolutely nailed to my desk doing the final work on the proofs and the diagrams and the photographs and so on that are going to go in the book. But it's exciting for me to revisit this subject and to do so with completely new evidence, because I took a lot of flack when I published Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995. I can't begin to tell you the insults that were thrown my way by archaeologists and historians and their friends in the media all around the world, who were absolutely convinced that their reference frame of history was right and that there could be no lost civilization. What's happened in the last 20 years is just a mass of new evidence that's come out. And that evidence needs to be put before the public in a coherent way. And that's why I've written Magicians of the Gods.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the book. It sounds very interesting. When I read the first one, it was probably 1997. I was in high school.
Right.
But I do remember that that was the first type of that book that I had ever read. And yeah. I remember the thought and what I came away with it was that that academics didn't actually know what was going on. Like, I just sort of naively thought that they did up to that point. But then I read that book and I realized that they were making things up just as much as anybody else, and that really we had no idea.
Absolutely. And let's look at the word history. Mm-hmm. It has the word story in it.
Right.
History is a narrative. It's mm-hmm. a story. It should not be mistaken with the facts. Mining out the facts behind the story is a work in progress. It isn't complete yet by any means. There are deep mysteries hidden in our past. And I believe we need to get to grips with those mysteries in order to understand what we are, actually, and how we function in the world we live in today. And to realize that we have too much hubris, too much confidence in ourselves and our technological society. In many ways, in mythological terms, we meet all the criteria of the next lost civilization. And this becomes an issue worthy of taking seriously when we realize that so recently such a gigantic cataclysm took place upon the Earth. Just, I'm not going around the world wearing a sandwich board saying that the end of the world is nigh, but twice a year our planet crosses the debris stream of that fragmented giant comet. We still cross it today. It's called the Taurid Meteor Stream. And every October, late October, early November, we have what some people call the Halloween fireworks, where you get fantastic meteor showers that come bursting in through our winter skies. Nobody thinks that they're dangerous. They're just pretty things to watch. But the astronomers who've worked on this field are very concerned about the Taurid Meteor Stream and the possibility that there may still be large fragments of that original giant comet circulating in the stream along with the much smaller ones that are responsible for the meteor showers. It's something I think science needs to take a proper look at. I think science is in denial about this at the moment. Science doesn't like cataclysms. There's a strong tendency in geology to be what they call uniformitarian, to imagine that things as they are now are a good guide to things that how they always were in the past, and that change operates gradually. It may not be so, and in fact the lessons of deep prehistory suggest strongly that it's not so. Don't forget, it took 10 years for the notion that the dinosaurs were made extinct by an asteroid to be accepted. Initially, that notion was dismissed as folly by most of science. But Lewis and Walter Alvarez stuck to their guns, and they kept bringing forth the evidence. And finally, they found the gigantic Chicxulub crater off the Yucatan and proved their case.
Hmm. Yeah, very interesting. For our last question, I would just like to talk again about your fiction work. And is a War God Part 3, I assume, will be coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm mm-hmm. so much looking forward to getting back to that.
Yeah.
I had written 50,000 words of it before I had to break off to really focus on Magicians of the Gods, the new nonfiction book. And those 50,000 words are sitting in my very computer that I'm talking to you on now. I'm looking forward to getting back and writing the further 100,000 words that will bring that trilogy to a conclusion, and that ends with the apocalyptic fall of Tenochtitlan, the Mexica, the Aztec capital, in August 1521, and to bring the arc of the journeys of all the characters to a conclusion there.
Do you have any other plans for any other fiction projects after that, or do they come to you as they come?
They tend to come to me as they come, and I'm very conscious. It's like an obligation I'm carrying. I must finish the War God trilogy, so that's my first priority. And Entangled, my first novel, is part one of a 2-part series. Right. I've also got about 100 pages of the second volume of Entangled written. So my priorities right now are to finish War God, to finish Entangled, and then we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see. one day, distantly, this whole work that I'd been involved in the nonfiction field about a lost civilization, Atlantis by any other name, may take root as a novel as well. Yeah. Possibly.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been attempted a few times in some fantasy and science fiction.
Has.
Yeah, it's a very interesting subject.
It is an interesting subject. People keep coming back to it again and again. Elements of it are in almost all post-apocalyptic fiction, mm-hmm. And that's my guess. Actually, we are living in a post-apocalyptic world.
Mm-hmm. Did you read the Dark Tower series by Stephen King?
Yeah,
all?
Yeah.
There's some of that walking by through this sort of primitive world, but seeing these old, antique technological yes. structures and stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Many writers go into this and do good stuff with it. And I hope the fact that I spent 25 years working in this field as a researcher might enable me to bring some other good stuff to the party.
Yeah, definitely. Finally, could you just let us know where we can find you and your work on the internet?
Okay, well, the main thing is my website, which is grahamhancock.com, www.grahamhancock.com. And on the very front page of that, there's, first of all, links to the new book, Magicians of the Gods. And secondly, there's link to my author Facebook page, on which I am extremely active. I find Facebook a really interesting phenomenon. I try to post there every day, sometimes a couple of times a day, and I try as far as I'm able in a very tight schedule to interact with people who comment on the page, because I can't tell you how many excellent leads I've been given and how many interesting bits of information have come my way because of this large Facebook community. There's something like 223,000 people who've liked that page who received the feed, and that's a vast community of mainly like-minded people. Like any Facebook page, I have some people who hate me and who come there only to hate me, but that's okay. That's fine. But what the best thing to do, by and large, with people who hate you is to try to love them, And I try. It's difficult, very difficult, but I try. I do try to do that. I really value the interaction that allows, and I think that's another great thing that's happening in the world today is that we are choosing to form communities of ideas around the world. The communities are no longer necessarily based on the nation that we happen to be born into, or the government that runs our lives, or our religious affiliation. We're choosing to affiliate ourselves with like-minded people wherever in the world they live, whatever their religious or cultural origins. We can communicate with them directly through the internet, and it is a great instrument for liberation of the human spirit, I think. Mm-hmm. Not without its problems, of course.
Right. Yeah, this technology seems to have both good and evil within it, like everything else.
It totally does, and like everything else, ultimately, the choice is up to us. It's ours.
Well, I want to really thank you for speaking with Dark Discoveries and granting us this interview. It's been a real pleasure for me.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, and that's all the questions I have. So if you have anything else you'd like to say, or we can
you know what?
Wrap it up.
I think we've covered it.